Guardian Unlimited.
Hello, I'm Julian Glover and welcome to Politics Weekly. We've just had a night of tight finishes and political drama in a contest that will shape the world. Not in Britain, of course, but in America. Suddenly, every journalist at Westminster seems to have decamped to California or Arizona and become an instant transatlantic expert. For my money, the big winner seems to be Obama. But then what would I know? This is a race in which all guesses seem to be wrong.
There is one thing on this February night that we do not need the final results to know. Our time has come.
We say, give us this economy to rebuild and this war to end. Give us this nation to heal, this world to lead, this moment to seize. I know we're ready. Thank you all, and God bless you.
But are we getting ahead of ourselves? The next president will not even take office until January 2009. In the meantime, President Bush remains in the White House, and this week one of his key allies, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, paid a rather low-key visit to London. What did she talk about? Afghanistan, of course. The British presence is under scrutiny again as the US and its European allies struggle to prevent an all-out civil war in the country. In April, extra British firepower will be sent to Helmand Province in southern Afghanistan. The Guardian's Richard Norton Taylor will be giving us his assessment of the chances of their success. And we turn our attention to bugging. Yes, it seems the spies are everywhere, and conversations were listened into 250,000 times in the first 9 months of 2007. At the weekend, it was revealed that MP Sadiq Khan was bugged while visiting a constituent in prison. One Guardian writer has compared the situation to East Germany under communism. Is that going too far? Joining me to discuss all this are three people with strong views about the power of politics. Standing up for the House of Commons, we have Martin Salter, the Labour MP for Reading West. On his website, he quotes The Guardian's description of him as a sharp, clever Labour backbencher. I hope that's true because I remember writing it. Alongside him is a man who once wanted to be a Labour MP, but that was a long time ago, and now he's a member of the Green Party, Peter Tatchell. He's currently taking on human rights abuses in Pakistan. And joining me for The Observer, Catherine Bennett makes her debut on Politics Weekly. A quick question for the three of you. Are you gripped by what's happening in America, or are we getting too obsessed too early? Catherine?
Yeah, I'm surprised at how gripped I am. And I think it's probably because it's so much more interesting and civilised looking in a way than what's happening here at the moment. You've only got to listen to Question Time to think you're going to switch straight over to any American news there is, really.
Martin?
I'm surprised how gripped I am, actually. I think it really matters. And this is a dreadful thing for a member of the British House of Commons to say, but it will really matter to our planet is the future of this election and the attitude of the new American regime to foreign policy, to climate change, and some of those big issues that we can have an impact on in Britain. But frankly, we need to drag progressive thought kicking and screaming from America into power and into influence on the world stage. So yes, it really does matter. And this whole notion that the next, well, one, that the Republicans look like they're going to lose, which is fantastic. And secondly, that whoever the Democratic nominee is going to be, it's either going to be a black man or a woman. And that's a sea change in American politics.
Peter?
I alternate between being gripped by the American elections and being bored and turned off by them. I think that the coverage has been vast in quantity, but often not very good in quality. We don't see much delineation in terms of what each of the candidates stand for and what the differences are. I mean, I keep finding people around me asking, well, what is the difference between Obama and Hillary, apart from rhetoric and style?
Questions to the Prime Minister. Speaker, the Prime Minister seems to see no limits. He is creating a surveillance state. Why has he consistently refused requests for more power to be given to the Information Commissioner? Why doesn't he do what they already do in Scotland and remove the DNA of innocent people from the database? Yeah. And why won't he act immediately to stop the scandalous fingerprinting of our children at school?
Mr. Speaker, people are reassured in this country by the presence of CCTV. I hope that he is not proposing to remove it. But that is one very important part of the investigative powers and the surveillance powers that we give the police to carry out their work. I would hope that he would look at the 2000 Act and look at the protections that have been put in place where there is surveillance and where there are intercepts. And that includes authorization by a senior officer, the right to appeal to an independent tribunal, a commissioner for surveillance that looks at the matters and reports annually. Now, we are taking the steps to protect the liberties of the citizens. I hope he will support that.
That was Nick Clegg and Gordon Brown in the House of Commons. Martin, do you think the level of surveillance in Britain is getting out of hand?
I don't think it's managed as well as it could be. And in fact, I'm on the Home Affairs Select Committee and we're doing a report at the moment into the Surveillance Society. But I have to say this, if my postbag as an MP is anything to go by, and my experience as 12 years as a councillor is anything to go by, I don't get the public asking me for less CCTV. They want more CCTV in their areas because it makes them feel safer. It's undoubtedly been a major factor in falling crime numbers and clearing up some crime hotspots. So on the one hand, we can worry about whether we're watched over too much. And on the other hand, the public basically want the cops to be able to catch the bad guys. And frankly, when it comes to an argument where you balance civil liberties against the effectiveness of the security services, there have been four major terrorist plots, all of which could have caused a massive loss of life.
So would you be happy to have a constituency surgery bugged by MI5?
Ah, well, there is a CCTV camera right outside my constituency office because I'm in the middle of the Oxford Road in Reading, which is, an area of some repute, to say the least. I spoke to Sadiq Khan earlier today. He is deeply fed up with what happened. I personally supported the Babar Ahmed campaign. I feel very, very strongly that people, whether they're accused of crimes or not, have got a right to a private audience with their Member of Parliament. For a lot of people to come and see their MP, it's an action of last resort, and I think they've got a right to feel that they're having that conversation in complete secrecy. And here's the irony of what the security services have done here and the Metropolitan Police. They may end up actually assisting the Babar Ahmed campaign by compromising his final appeal against extradition. I think it's outrageous that Babar Ahmed isn't being tried for criminal offences in this country rather than Britain subcontracting the criminal justice process to the United States.
Catherine, do you think the government's got a case?
I think it's far too extensive. I think the surveillance is getting out of hand. But I do think it's quite strange to hear all the MPs getting terribly sort of exercised about it now that one of them is being apparently unjustly surveilled when, you know, they haven't really participated in the campaign to kind of do anything about it. That seems to be led by some commentators and other pressure groups and civil liberties pressure groups. Part of me thinks actually I quite like MPs to be bugged all the time when they're on the phone to their wives planning how much they're going to get paid and the different hours their children are going to work. But yeah, sure, constituents. Obviously, they have to be private meeting.
Peter, do you think we're heading into a police state?
I think that'd be a bit strong, but I think certainly in the last decade, we've seen one of the most fundamental shifts in the balance of power between the state and the citizen, certainly since the Second World War and possibly as far back as the period immediately after the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars. The raft and range of increased state powers has been phenomenal. The pace has been breathtaking. And I think, in answer to Martin's point, I think his postbag isn't full because most people don't realise the sheer massive scale of what the state is now doing or able to do. And you can say, well, look, these powers are all there for good purposes to protect us. But once you establish the infrastructure of a surveillance state and emergency powers which give the government and the police and other state agencies carte blanche to do what they like in certain circumstances, then really you don't have a protection against the malevolent use of those powers by a less benign government or police service in the future.
Martin, what do you think to that?
Two things. I mean, I think it was a pretty cheap shot from Catherine. I don't think she really wants MPs to be bugged while they're talking to their wives or husbands.
And they don't need to be. They're sitting next to each other in the Commons.
Well, exactly. And I hold no brief for Derek Conway, but I'll tell you now, the amount of resources we get to manage our staffs, particularly in busy urban seats with big immigration caseloads, it is pathetic. The staff that work for me work for not enough money and they work incredibly hard and know none of them are related to me. In terms of intercept evidence, the debate that's raging this week is quite ironic because you've got Justice and Liberty, two main civil liberties organisations in this country, pleading with the government to accept intercept evidence as part of the debate on counter-terrorism powers. Well, of course, if you accept intercept evidence, it means you actually accede to the idea that security services are bugging people in the first place.
Doesn't it mean that they actually think it's going to reduce the need for people to be detained? That's why they're supporting it.
No, but the point is this, Catherine. On the one hand, you've got the same organisation saying there's too much intercepting going on, and then with the next breath, they're saying, oh, well, we must have that intercept evidence in because that negates the need for extending pre-charge detention. I'm afraid it's completely contradictory.
Well, I think what they're saying is, in legitimate instances, there are grounds and right grounds for interception and bugging. And at the moment, the problem is that the whole system of bugging interception is not under sufficient scrutiny. In some instances, it appears to be excessive and out of control and not under proper jurisdiction and oversight. But if you sort that out, then certainly, as Catherine says, allowing intercept evidence, as most other countries around the world do, that would speed up the process to secure real justice and help ensure that there were fewer miscarriages of justice and that the police wasted less time on chasing red herrings.
Well, thanks for that. Condoleezza Rice was in town to meet Gordon Brown this week, specifically to talk about Afghanistan. This week it was also announced that more UK troops would be sent to the country in April to try to avert the threat of civil war. This is what The Guardian's security affairs correspondent, Richard Norton-Taylor, had to say.
A new deployment of troops, a pretty robust brigade, was announced by Des Brown to the Commons, where for the first time since the Second World War, all regiments of the Para 1, 2, 3 and 4 will be used, or the Parachute Regiment, and sort of extra firepower, really, with new helicopters and so on, but the same number of British troops in southern Afghanistan, about 7,700. Now, will this do the job? I think, you know, it's a question of the Taliban. Is the British soldiers are winning battles on a sort of day-by-day basis. A question of holding the ground and indeed convincing the Taliban that they're there to stay, which I think the British have done. Whether there's enough British troops there or not is another matter, given the versatility, really, and the staying power of Taliban fighters. The new deployment comes out of really what people say is a crucial time for NATO's involvement in Afghanistan, also actually for the credibility of the alliance itself. You know, although the Taliban has been beaten in a classic sense in sort of battlefields of southern Afghanistan, they're reorganizing, really, and they're increasingly using suicide bombers or explosive devices on their mines, which the insurgents have been using in Iraq, of course, which is more threatening. There's a whole question of suspicion of Karzai, who's got elections coming up next year. The NATO people say he's a very weak and incoherent sort of government. He's got his corrupt people around who he needs. So it's not a very pretty picture at the moment. Maybe the next few months will be crucial, actually. If more troops do come, more helicopters and so on, Taliban commanders do switch over, which is possible, then things will get better in the next few months. But if they don't, it's a really, really serious problem in a region of the world which British Prime Minister and others have said is the front line of the fight against international terrorism. And the risk of Afghanistan going back into civil war again or becoming a failed state is actually quite real.
Well, Peter, you've been looking at what's happening in next-door Pakistan. Do you think we're losing the fight in the region?
I think from the very time we first stepped foot in Afghanistan, we were doomed to fail. And that's because we went there based on Western geopolitical strategic interests and not the interests of the people of Afghanistan. That's the big problem. We're not fighting this war from the point of view of the people of Afghanistan. It's about our Western interests. Ask yourself, why do people in parts of Afghanistan support the Taliban? They support it because their regions are impoverished, because they suffer discrimination and persecution as minority nationalities, and also, of course, because the Taliban strong-arms themselves into those regions and oppresses the people and terrorizes them. But we aren't dealing with the side of the equation, which is about the oppression and discrimination and poverty that people feel. In Helmand province, where a large proportion of the British troops are based, I don't know the exact proportion, but about 30% of the population are Baluch. Now, the Baluch people are victims of the colonial-era boundaries. They're spread between Iran, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. If the British and the Americans had any sense, they would positively be supporting Baluch nationalism as a counterweight to the Taliban, because the Baluch are traditionally a democratic secular people, very strong democratic secular traditions, very anti-fundamentalist. But now, because of the indiscriminate bombing of their areas by NATO troops, more and more the Baluch are turning to the Taliban to protect them against the invaders.
Catherine, do you agree it's the West's fault, really, what's happening?
Well, I think to the extent that it's just a complete mess, yes. I mean, how could it be otherwise, since they don't seem to have had any coherent plan? I think it's just terrifying to hear that, you know, NATO is arguing about what they're doing there and what they should be doing and what their strategy should be. And yet there are troops out there, 150 yards from Taliban front lines, being shot at every day for 140 days. It's hideous, and it inspires no confidence.
Do you think the battle's going to continue, or are Britain just going to pull out in the end?
It's just going to go on and on and on. They're saying we're going to be there for 20 years, aren't they? And there's nothing that suggests that we shouldn't believe that, or even longer.
Martin, 20 years, would you support that?
Well, I certainly think we're going to be in Afghanistan for an awful long time. And I mean, first of all, Peter's absolutely right to identify the tribal nature of Afghanistan. Afghanistan barely exists as a nation. It's a series of tribes. It is ungovernable. No one will govern it. I'm not sure the Afghans can govern it as a nation. The other thing we need to think about is that the Taliban isn't a liberation struggle as such. And in many places, it's a nasty criminal conspiracy hiding behind Islamic fundamentalism, it will control a substantial proportion of the poppy trade. Afghan is the breadbasket, if you like, of heroin production for most of the world. But we are in there as a result of the United Nations resolution. People forget that. There are 38 nations involved, 42,000 troops are involved. We have seen the skilling up of an Afghan national army. It's still pretty hodgepodge. We have seen a substantial number of girls and young people once again able to go to school. There has been progress. And it comes back to Peter's point. Until we can find an alternative source of income, then it suits the interests of the poor Afghan to find something that will help him and his family survive. And I'm afraid there are greater returns in selling the poppy and feeding the drugs trade than there are in engaging with ISAF and the Western forces. Personally, I think we should be buying the poppies off them at a better rate than the drug dealers give them and burning the stuff.
You're using it to fund the global shortage of morphine.
Well, there you go. There's another way forward. I just think we need a little bit more lateral thinking. It really is a fight for survival from people in the most poorest region. And actually providing them with alternative sources of income will do more to defeat the Taliban than some kind of enforced Afghan nationalism, which has never really existed.
Well, back in Westminster this week, David Cameron resumed battle with Gordon Brown in the Commons. Here was how Simon Hoggart saw events.
Well, for the second week running, the big story at Westminster, which is MPs' expenses and the way some of them at least are managing to fiddle them by bending the rules or ignoring them altogether, didn't crop up at Prime Minister's questions. And of course, the reason is that both sides have their bad apples, which we're told may be poisoning the rest of the barrel. What with Nicholas Winterton and his wife and their quite extraordinary means of getting extra money out of the house through giving their own home away to their children, and then claimed large sums of public money to pay rent to their children because they were staying in the house. It's a bizarre arrangement. It's not actually illegal, but I think the new Speaker's Committee that he's set up to look at these things will have to take a very close look at some of those arrangements. So, of course, it didn't come up because on the Labour side, naturally, you've got Peter Hain and Harriet Harman, both of whom seem to have bent the rules to the extent that Peter Hain had to resign. So, what did David Cameron choose to attack the Prime Minister on this time? Well, he returned to dithering, and the way he did that was to say that the Prime Minister spent all his time setting up reviews and never actually taking a decision. He asked one of those rhetorical questions, how many reviews have you set up since you became Prime Minister? Prime Minister, of course, didn't know. David Cameron did. He said you set up 52 reviews, which works out at one every 4 days since you became Prime Minister. No wonder you haven't got time to open your post, he said, referring to the missing letter that warned him, allegedly, about the bugging of the Labour MP. Though there was one glorious moment towards the very end when a Tory MP, Angela Watkinson, said that everybody now felt that cannabis should be reclassified as Class B. The police thought so. Experts in mental disorder thought so, and she thought so. Gordon Brown said, "We are waiting for a report," which of course summed up everything David Cameron had been saying.
Well, Martin, you're an MP, so you better put the case for the defence. Is it a luxury life of expenses, taxis, nice dinners, all paid for by the taxpayer?
I could get really irritated when journalists start lecturing me about expenses. Expenses are what journalists have. I have a budget to manage an office in Westminster and an office in my constituency. It's a full-time service to 70,000 constituents. The money we have and the resources we have are not sufficient. We can't pay our staff what they're worth. I can't reward my staff if they go on training courses. I can't give them increments and the rest of it. And I think that's a real, real shame. And I think there's a world of difference between a busy urban seat with a huge caseload and some of these sleepy country seats where it is true, some MPs have maximised their own family resources in the way that we saw with Derek Conway and others. But the system is a mess. And what I object to, and Simon knows this, what I object to with Simon's piece is lumping Derek Conway, who was embezzling the taxpayer. You know, I'll say it. He can sue me if I'm wrong. He was embezzling the taxpayer with someone like Hain or Harman or George Osborne. What they did was fail to register in this ridiculously complex system that we've got. It didn't cost the public purse a single penny for Osborne's failure to register on time or Hain's failure to register on time. They're two different things. One is embezzlement and another one is a ridiculously complex system that frankly needs sorting out. Apart from the party whips, your constituents, your own political party, we're actually accountable to seven different bodies, most of whom give you contradictory advice. We're accountable to the Speaker, the Parliamentary Commissioner for Standards, the Standards and Privilege Committee, the Sergeant Arms Department, the Department for Finance and Admin, the Electoral Commission, and the Committee for Standards in Public Life. It is a joke, and we will only sort this out with absolute transparency and with an overhaul of the Byzantine administration regime in the House of Commons.
Peter, it's really journalists' fault. MPs are just doing their best. Do you agree?
Well, I think a lot of what Martin says makes sense. I agree, from the period when I stood as a Labour candidate in Bermondsey in 1983 and now as a Green Party candidate for Oxford East, the amount of constituency work, I'm not even elected yet, but the amount of constituency work is huge. And I think MPs should actually get more resources for staff, for researchers, for caseload work to help their constituents. But that in terms of expenses, general expenses, that needs to be tightened up massively, because what some of these MPs are doing, if they'd been doing it in a private business, they'd be out the door tomorrow, if not facing criminal charges.
Catherine, what do you think people in the street looking at MPs now, what do they think?
Well, first of all, you know, all your problems, you know, diddums, really. I think it's just extraordinary. There can be any question that this isn't just a piece of outrageous greed. And the problem is we don't know that it's just one or two bad apples, because you don't tell us which of you employ your family members and who doesn't. And the idea that nobody really has stood up on either side, on any side, and said, we stand for cleaning this whole thing up. This will not be allowed anymore. You'll behave like normal members of the population, particularly people using public money. Why does nobody say that? And so it's always, you know, well, we have a very hard time. We need to sort this little thing. It's too confusing. It's just corrupt. And if you think, actually, that, you know, journalists have it easy with expenses compared with MPs, you're living, you know, in the age of scoop, I'm afraid. Journalists have to show receipts. You don't have to show receipts, do you, for up to £250? I mean, no normal person can believe that.
Give you a practical example. John McDonnell, Labour MP for Hayes and Hindon, his constituency covers Harmondsworth and Colnbrook immigration detention centres. Just by that mere coincidence, he gets inundated with requests for people who feel they've been unfairly processed by the asylum adjudication system or being unfairly deported. And to his credit, he takes them up. But there are hundreds, and he hasn't got the staff. He needs, because of his particular circumstance, I would say at least two or three full-time paid staff just to deal with those issues. Before anybody says anything, I've dealt with John lots of these cases, and he has discovered lots of people who have been unlawfully deported, who've been put before asylum tribunals without legal representation, who've been badly treated by the system. And it's only thanks to John and his staff's hard work and dedication that he's managed to get justice in the end. So in those cases, MPs need more resources, but they've got to be properly regulated and controlled.
Catherine just takes a media story and then says, therefore, all MPs are corrupt. You know, and that's just stupid, ill-informed, lazy reaction from someone that works for the media, which is one of the least accountable public institutions that we've got. I have no problem with us declaring every receipt. I've got no problem with that at all. Transparency is the way forward. There's no doubt about that. I've got no problem with that. But we have a system at the moment that is a mess. And MPs can get themselves into all sorts of trouble by asking one arm of the House of Commons, have I got to do this, and get answer A, and ask another department that gives you answer B.
But surely MPs are in charge of the system. I mean, you could make the Speaker do a bit more than he does. And you're open. Not all your colleagues are.
No, but I'll tell you what, it's fundamentally wrong. I don't want to be a self-employed business unit. You know, I didn't go to Parliament to manage my payroll, to be an accountant and the rest of it. I see no reason why the staff of MPs aren't employed by the House of Commons. We might get to hire and fire. And the editor of The Guardian, I'm sure, doesn't individually manage his own payroll, doesn't individually pore over the stationery catalogue and the rest of it. We are sucked into this immense bureaucracy that's been created. Yes, you're right, Julian, we should sort it out. But we didn't go there to be office managers. We went there to be public representatives and do a job on behalf of the people that we represent. And engage in the battle of ideas, not to become bureaucrats. It's our inability to be good bureaucrats that gets some of us in trouble, like Hayne and Harman, and it's the deliberate corruption of seeking to exploit the system that means that our system should be more robust. And frankly, I think there is an argument for MPs not being the direct employer. That won't make me popular with my colleagues, but I think that would sort out a lot of these problems, along with total transparency.
I would make it a criminal offence for members of Parliament to tell lies.
There is an issue here, and that is, where the hell is this going to end? Who is primarily lodging complaints to the Commissioner for Standards, Commissioner for Standards and Privileges against MPs? It's fellow MPs or candidates. We're like kind of two scorpions in a glass case. We basically end up eating each other. And I think, who's going to want to fund political parties? Because the taxpayer certainly doesn't want to do that. We will really suffer in terms of the standards of people that are going to want to come forward and the respect that our public institutions, if they've got much left. I think this is a big, big wake-up call. And I really hope that Gordon, in the lifetime of this Parliament, sorts this, because I know he wants to.
Well, it's clearly a mess and something's going to have to be done. And there's great confusion, too, across the Atlantic with the primaries we've had this week. The closest fought in a generation, the Democrats really battling it out between Clinton and Obama. Catherine, do you think it's really reinvigorated American politics?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I think it's if it's reinvigorated even me, it must have been, you know, closer to home, it must have been very invigorating indeed. And I think it's going to get better and better, isn't it? Because now, as Peter says, it's been hard to tell, you know, what the differences were on the Democratic side, but they're going to have to be more specific and there'll be fewer of these sonorous statements coming out and more policy things, and that will be interesting. I think it's great.
Do you think it's too much personality at the moment?
No, I think there's just the right amount.
It's all personality, Catherine, at the moment, isn't it? We don't even know if we're going to end up with a National Health Service in America.
Well, they'll have to start speaking the personalities at some point, won't they, about more things than we want change and say who they are going to talk to and what they're going to do. And I suppose that's the next step, isn't it?
And Peter, if we do get change, it's going to be the end of the Bush era. I mean, what do you think we're going to get from Bush in the last year? Where do you see it going?
Well, can I first say that before we get too chirpy-chirpy about this whole American electoral process, we should remember that the American system of conducting elections is itself deeply flawed. There were serious allegations, not proven but not unproven, about President Bush's first election with the results particularly in Florida, and then in his re-election, the results in Ohio. And, you know, there are very many esteemed political commentators and journalists who've written huge screeds looking at the flaws in the voting machines and the process of actually counting the votes. And I've got to say that whatever the result is, whoever emerges as the winner, we can't at this stage be actually sure that they won by fair means. So that's got to be a big concern. Going back to Catherine's point, yes, it has obviously reinvigorated and energized a whole tranche of American people who, you know, never been involved in politics before. Every night in the news you see interviewing some 16-year-old or some 50-year-old who said, I've never been involved in a political campaign before, but I'm out to support Hillary or Obama. Or
pay to say yeah. that, Peter. Come on, get real,
The size of the meetings addressed by the candidates, is obviously there is a big, big awakening going on. Whether it will produce anything, and to go back to your question, you know, we are at the end of the Bush era, and a good thing, but what is going to replace it? I'm sure that either Obama or Hillary will be better than Bush, undoubtedly. But whether they'll be much better, I'm not sure. On some issues, things will change, undoubtedly. But I don't think we should give any great hope. Both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton do come out of a certain corporate background, big power Democratic politics, different strands, different sides, but different elements of the Democratic Party establishment. If we go back and look at the history of Democratic presidents, they've always been better than Republican ones, but often not that much better, and often with many downsides as well.
Martin, I mean, are we just spectators, or what we're saying and debating actually might influence America?
I don't know if we'll influence America, but I know two things. One, the American election at the moment may be energising more people, but it's from a tremendously low base. Only about 75% of Americans are actually registered to vote. The turnout of presidential elections is only about 50%, which means that it is a less than 20% of American citizens actually end up deciding who the most powerful politician in the world is.
Like the Labour government in Britain. 21%, 22%.
Peter, yeah. When you were standing as a candidate, you would have accepted any percentage that got you into office, and you damn well know that. The second issue, and the most important issue, is that neocons lose. Absolutely crucial that the neocons lose. And that's why I'm rather pleased that McCain is pulling ahead of some of his more right-wing competitors. The neocon philosophy has been an absolute disaster for our planet. I mean, it talks in terms of almost permanent warfare in order to justify American economic interests. Iraq was only a warm-up for the more extreme neocons like Wolfowitz and Pearl. I mean, Iran was their next target. And I would just be delighted to see that quite corrosive and destructive political force which dominated American political life and American political discourse put back in its box. And I think whoever wins this election, it's going to be a defeat for the neocons, and that makes me a very, very happy bunny. I think really, I suppose, I would like Obama's rhetoric and hope and vision and sort of Clinton's experience, because my one worry about Obama is, has he been tested under fire?
I think it's really strange, this idea that Clinton's got experience. I mean, it's weird. I mean, she's got experience. She's a wag, basically, isn't she?
She's been a senator.
Not for that long, hasn't covered herself in glory. When she was given something to do, health, she messed it up. And this thing, they were saying, well, she's been to all these different countries. She went there as a wife and girlfriend. I mean, you know, and spent time shopping with all the other wives and girlfriends. You know, I don't think she's got any sort of discernible advantage in that at all.
Thank you for that. Well, that's it from this edition of Politics Weekly. Thanks to all my guests, the Labour MP for Reading West, Martin Salter, Green Party member Peter Tatchell, and Catherine Bennett from The Observer. Just like Parliament, we'll be taking a break next week, and Nick Watt will be back in a fortnight. I'm Julian Glover. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Guardian Unlimited.